I'm Maggie Creech, host of Revolution Revisited. If this podcast has changed how you think about the American Revolution or just made history come alive again, I'd love your help. Leave a rating or a short review wherever you listen. It only takes a minute, and it helps us amplify Virginia's history, connecting new listeners to the past and supporting the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Thank you for being part of the story.
For 250 years, Virginia's story has been shaped by people from many places and the traditions, ideas, and dreams they've brought with them. We the People, a new exhibition at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, explores the stories of achievement and resilience and communities of those who have immigrated to the Commonwealth. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org/we the people.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. Invisible Ink. Dead drops, secret codes, double agents, hidden identities. All of this may conjure up images of James Bond or Jason Bourne. But if you trade tuxedos for tricorn hats and Aston Martins for horses, this could be a real scene from the American Revolution. Today, we're stepping into the shadows to explore how espionage helped win the revolution. Who were these revolutionary spies? How did they operate? And did George Washington outfight the British or outspy them? To help us separate fact from fiction, we're joined by...
I'm Amanda Olke. I'm the Director of Adult Education at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. And I've been a spy 22 years and have done all sorts of things from games to exhibits to many, many programs ranging from spies teaching you how to counterfeit, but only in legal ways, to surveillance in the streets of D.C.
The American Revolution was fought in battlefields and back rooms, with stolen information, coded messages, and people willing to risk everything for intelligence. Espionage is woven into human history, with evidence dating all the way back to ancient Egypt. By the 18th century, spying was an essential part of diplomacy and warfare across the globe. The American Revolution was no different. American intelligence efforts began in earnest at the onset of the conflict, and it really wasn't all that glamorous. In true 18th century fashion, one of the first efforts began with, you guessed it, a committee. In late 1775, Congress created yet another Committee of Correspondence, this time to communicate with colonial agents in Britain and friends in other parts of the world to secretly secure arms and supplies for the revolution. Because what better way to keep something secret than having it written down on paper? Owing to the nature of the correspondence, the members began to add the word secret to the committee's title, and soon it was known as the Committee of Secret Correspondence. Among its members were Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, and Robert Morris. One of their key contacts was Arthur Lee, who worked with the French agent Beaumarchais to pass along news of American victories. Those reports helped convince France to quietly send much-needed gunpowder and military supplies to the colonies. In 1777, the Committee of Secret Correspondence became the Committee for Foreign Affairs, but it continued its intelligence work. While Congress built intelligence networks overseas, Washington was zeroed in on spying closer to home. Drawing on lessons he had learned during the French and Indian War, he began developing an intelligence system that relied on informants, coded communications, and deception.
Washington is very, very focused on intelligence from the get-go. He knows it is very, very important. He paid for intelligence. He paid to set up spy networks. He actively encouraged the distribution of disinformation. He supported covert action. So he really, really saw it as an integral part of his operation. And there's this famous quote by a British General Beckworth that appears in the news later that the Americans did not outfight the British, we outspied them. So this is part of the story from the very beginning. Intelligence is on the docket. It is shadowy stuff, but it is not in the shadows for this early government.
In 1776, on the heels of the Declaration of Independence, a group known as Knowlton's Rangers was formed by George Washington. It was the Continental Army's first organized intelligence unit. Washington selected Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Knowlton, a veteran of the French and Indian War and the Battle of Bunker Hill, to lead them in their efforts to run raids and reconnaissance missions throughout New York. But there was no training manual for Revolutionary War spies. And that meant Knowlton's Rangers were sort of making the playbook up as they went, kind of trial by fire. And sometimes they made costly mistakes. No story illustrates this better than that of Nathan Hale. After the British captured Long Island, Washington needed to know where they would strike next. 21-year-old Nathan Hale volunteered to cross enemy lines disguised as a Dutch schoolmaster. While gathering intel, Hale was captured by British forces and directly sentenced to hang without trial by General William Howe, becoming the first spy executed in the Revolutionary War. Today, Nathan is hailed for his final words. "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." But like most great lines in history, it is undocumented in official records. Despite his ultimate sacrifice for the new nation, Hale was not hugely celebrated at the time, because unfortunately, his mission was sort of a failure. Today, statues of him stand in a handful of locations, including the CIA headquarters in Virginia. Outside of these Rangers, Washington was also working with a few spy rings early in the war. As the war raged in the North in 77, Washington opted to funnel more resources into intelligence gathering in New York.
There's some very interesting pieces to this Washington financing a spy network that's very near and dear to us at the Spy Museum, because we have the letter that Washington wrote to a man named Nathaniel Sackett in February of 1777. And Washington is asking Sackett to obtain for him the earliest and best intelligence of the designs of the enemy. And Washington writes, "For your care and trouble in this business, I agree on behalf of the public to allow you $50 for calendar month and herewith give you a warrant to the paymaster general for the sum of $500 to pay those whom you find necessary to employ." So this is money. This is budgeted. It is going through the paymaster general.
So in this letter, General George Washington offers Nathaniel Sackett $50 a month, which is more than $1,000 a month today, to spy for the Continental Army, plus another $500 to set up a spy network. He gets to work crafting some strategies, like adopting code names to increase security, gathering intel, and training others in the art of spying, including a young officer by the name of Benjamin Talmadge, who is about to become a big deal in our story.
So Nathaniel Sackett begins gathering intel. Washington is not satisfied with him. He does gather some information about British boat building and preparations, but in 6 months, Washington is not happy with him. But Nathaniel Sackett has identified Benjamin Talmadge, and has done some training with him. And that is great because he then assembles what we know as the Culper Ring with people that he knew in the New York area, people he trusted. And it's so much fun because you've got a whaleboat man, you've got a person who is running a coffee shop, a store in New York City, who is posing very much as a loyalist. So they are covering 55 miles around New York to try to circumvent these British troops and get information through the network.
If you've heard of or seen the AMC series Turn, this is part of that story. And fun fact, parts of Turn were shot at VMHC's historic property, Virginia House. By 1778, the Culper Ring was a group of civilians operating in enemy-occupied areas with a secure means of transmitting info back to headquarters. And that sounds obvious, but it's significant. These were not soldiers. Spying was yet another way individuals could participate in the war without direct combat. Within the Culper Ring, each member was known by an alias and a code number, recognizing that concealing their identities was critical. None of their identities were revealed during the war, but today we've got a list of them. In the ring, there was Major Benjamin Talmadge, the leader, with the alias John Bolton, code number 721. Abraham Woodall, alias Samuel Culper Sr., codename 722. And Robert Townsend, alias Samuel Culper Jr., code number 723. George Washington was code number 711. And interestingly, the ring was not exclusively men. We also have Anna Strong, supposedly Agent 355. In addition to concealing their true identities, the members of the ring had to play specific roles in their communities in order to gather intelligence.
Robert Townsend is so compelling in pretending to be a loyalist to the crown that his family, he goes to his grave with his family thinking he was a loyalist, and yet he was Culper Jr. in this spy ring, a very devoted part of the spy ring, gathering intel in this New York City that's held by the British and sharing it out. So this is just this crazy spy ring that's got a little piece of, you know, everybody. And then Anna Strong, who's part of that, that people often claim she is Agent 355, which was part of the Culper Rings. And you hear these stories about Anna Strong would hang a petticoat on a line. Can't really find the evidence of that, but it's a fun story.
On the whole, the Culper Ring can be considered a success. They are credited with two major breaks. The agents learned of a British plan to launch an expedition in Rhode Island in 1780. They reported the type of supplies being loaded on British transports, and with that information, the duration of the campaign and the destination of the troops could be predicted. Benjamin Talmadge also contributed to the apprehension of Englishman John André, which led to a reveal of the treasonous activity of Benedict Arnold.
And, you know, I often see the Culper Ring mentioned as being active in unmasking Benedict Arnold. Now, Talmadge, who ran the spy ring, was very involved with that because when they find the documents that bring Benedict Arnold under question, these were carried by the young Englishman, John André. When they find him and they find these documents that he's carrying, where Arnold's ready to turn over the fort to the British, people were scared. The people that caught him were a little bit intimidated. Are they going to run afoul of Arnold? He's a powerful man. But Talmadge really becomes very suspicious and pushes that. So that's definitely a Talmadge win in the world of espionage.
So how did 18th century spies carry out these espionage efforts? It's a combination of techniques. There's good old-fashioned eavesdropping, communication through code, invisible ink, and in some cases, hiding in plain sight by using social standing to your advantage. Washington encouraged it all, from the expected to the outlandish.
We have the European techniques of opening mail, reading mail quietly behind the scenes in black chambers. Guess what? George Washington set up some stations in New York to read people's mail quietly and diplomatic posts quietly. Human spies from the dawn of time to today. We've got human beings spying, listening in. But George Washington also really went in for some innovative activities. He was a big fan of invisible ink. So we've got secret messages, whether they're in codes or ciphers, or invisible inks. And he also liked some technology like submarines for covert action. In the lobby at the Spy Museum, we have a reproduction of Bushnell's turtle. And this is a wooden sub. It was pedal powered. And the idea was that the operator would pedal through a harbor, get underneath a big British warship and attach a mine, attach a bomb, and then pedal away to safety. And this was built, it was implemented, it didn't manage to get the mine on the ship. But Washington was really, really impressed with the effort and commended the inventor and was totally supportive of the turtle. And that submarine does show up in the television show Turn.
So let's dig into these methods in more detail, starting with codes and ciphers. These were an incredibly popular and often effective means for secret communication in the 18th century. In the VMHC's collection, there are a handful of coded letters by Arthur Lee. Lee used a dictionary code, where a published dictionary is the basis and the desired word is indicated by page number, column, and line. The Lee brothers, Richard Henry, William, and Arthur, used the 1777 edition of John Entick's New Spelling Dictionary. In one of Lee's letters to the Committee of Secret Correspondence, he outlines the dictionary code should be used in correspondence related to French aid moving forward, stating, "This book is better than the last I sent you. It is to decipher what I write to you and for you to write by. This is done by putting the page where the word is to be found and the letter of the alphabet corresponding in order with the word. As there are more words in a page than the letters of the alphabet, the letter must be doubled or trebled. I cannot use this until I know it is safe. You can write to Mrs. Lee on Tower Hill in a woman's hand. If you have both books, say the children are well. If the first only, the eldest child is well. If this, the youngest child is well. They will let this pass." As a spymaster, Washington encouraged writing in code because it was safer for couriers, the ones carrying the message, and provided an extra layer of security if a message was intercepted. Certainly, one of the most important components of writing in code was to ensure that the code didn't get compromised, but perhaps more important was making sure that recipients could effectively and consistently decipher it. The Culper spies had a codebook of their own, developed by Talmadge to protect their identities and their communications.
Now, you're going to want to make sure that all the people in the ring are going to need to have a copy of the cipher book, and you're going to have to protect that with your life. And your cipher is only as good as your security around your cipher key. Now, a book code is an interesting one where if you and the person you're corresponding with have the same book and you are communicating by page 5, line 7, location 17, you know, and you're going to meticulously spell out the word from the page from the book. And that is, you need the shared book. So you could intercept a letter that says 573, but you need to know what book they're using. So that one's cool, especially if you have an esoteric book that is not common, because if you choose something really common, maybe I think it's a book code. And I'm like, well, we've all got this edition of the Bible.
Beyond coded messages, both the British and Americans used a variety of invisible inks during the war. One method involved using sympathetic inks. A secret message would be written in a sympathetic ink, which, when dry, was invisible. Later, when the reader applied the second chemical or the reagent, there would be a chemical reaction that revealed the message. There were several sympathetic ink formulas available at the time of the American Revolution.
Washington was an incredible fan of invisible ink. He called sympathetic stain. And John Jay's brother was actually very actively creating different invisible ink techniques for Washington to use. And one of my favorite things that we do in kids' workshops, and I have done at a lot of large community events, is giving people a chance to try one of Washington's invisible inks. And that is, you write in gallic acid, and then it is revealed by the application of ferrous sulfate. And that is definitely one that Washington used. There are all variety. What, you know, if you've been a kid, we most of us have been kids, and maybe you've tried to write in lemon juice and then reveal it with heat.
In case you weren't that kid, here's one of the simpler methods. Use acid and heat. A message could be written in something that will dry without detection, commonly lemon juice, vinegar, and lime juice. And when heat is applied, the message is revealed. This works because the acidity weakens the paper fibers, and when heat is applied, those weakened fibers turn brown faster. So you know that scene in National Treasure where a secret message is written in invisible ink on the back of the Declaration of Independence, and Benjamin Gates, Nicolas Cage, discovers it by applying lemon juice and using the heat from his breath and a hairdryer to reveal it? We're not saying there's a secret message on the back of the Declaration of Independence. We're just saying it's a period-appropriate possibility. Creating invisible words was not the only critical part of this covert communication.
So I'd say one of the main things about invisible ink is how you hide it. You want it embedded in a document that has other writing, maybe something, maybe you want to bore the person who's looking at the letter, but you're going to want to have a cover for it, just really banal contents, and then send it secretly.
They also occasionally communicated via masked letters, where the sender used a cutout mask to write a hidden message and then covered the rest of the page with meaningless text. The mask and the letter were then sent to the recipient separately, so the secret stayed hidden if intercepted.
The mask letters we don't seem to have used as much, but there's a very cool one that you can see online used by the English general, British General Clinton, and it's kind of a vase-shaped mask. So the person you're writing needs to have this cutout document. You have the cutout document. Then you're going to write a whole letter or document, but the goods are just in the shape that's revealed by the mask. So once again, these have to be kept separate, and you've got to have your really important information in the special area, but then you have to fill in sentences around it that will make it make sense, because otherwise you'd say, well, gosh, this stuff in the center seems to have a different flow of penmanship or verbiage.
These spies use disinformation and dead drops as well. Dead drops are a technique where agents exchange information or items by leaving them in a prearranged concealed location, maintaining anonymity and avoiding surveillance.
These folks are sophisticated. They're using couriers. They're hiding letters, teeny, teeny, tiny messages in a quill pen. Or there's this great story about a man who is carrying a secret message in like a silver ball, but he swallowed it and then they made him throw it up. Like, it's just crazy. He had to throw it up a couple of times, and then he did end up being hung for being a spy. So they're very aware of being secret, of keeping stuff out of the enemy's hands, and then also the fabulous disinformation technique of inflating your numbers, confusing your enemy about what you're planning to do.
Washington's spy network, including the Culper Ring, produced a constant stream of reports, rumors, and observations that had to be carefully evaluated. Instead of accepting any single account at face value, Washington looked for patterns across multiple sources, comparing intelligence from his agents with information from British deserters and local civilians. By cross-checking what he learned, he was able to separate reliable intelligence from misinformation and make better strategic decisions on the battlefield. This challenges the idea of spying as being all about secret missions. In reality, a big part of espionage is deciding which pieces of information are reliable and which are not.
That is exactly why there's so many different ways of gathering intelligence. Even at this time today, we have so many different types of intelligence, electronic intelligence, signals intelligence, all sorts of different intelligence, but they did too. You've got locals. A lot of information might come from enslaved people who are seeking safety in camps, but have fled a war zone, and they can tell you what troops did they see? Where were they based? So you might get eyewitness accounts. You might get letters written to you sent by a courier. Maybe they've been falsified. Maybe somehow you've picked up materials that turn out to be fake and are plans. That's why you need all these different streams of intelligence, whether you've got your raiders on horseback who are fanning out and checking things out from as far afield as they can get. So you need all that so you can verify, is this correct or not? There's a story about Washington would encourage any of the people he was working with who were going into the British camps. If you're asked, if you're pretending to be a loyalist or a local, really blow up the number of troops that the Americans have, really inflate those numbers, the manpower. And there's one kind of fun back and forth where a spy comes back and says, well, I gathered this intel, but they were not buying what I was telling them about American manpower. They did not believe the Patriots had the numbers that he was sharing with them. It's one of the tools in the arsenal of a very brilliant commander, because you're going to get intelligence and you don't always believe it. And Washington didn't always believe it, because you're getting a lot of inputs, which is amazing. You know, we always think the past is sort of not interconnected, since we all have smartphones and laptops, but they've got fast horses. Washington's got raiders out there, the first military intelligence covert action command that are searching for information from up and down the countryside, gathering it anywhere they can. So it's part of the story. It's part of the winning.
In a July 12th, 1780 letter from the VMHC collection, George Washington writes to Henry Lee requesting he engage in reconnaissance around Sandy Hook, New Jersey, and watch for any British naval activity. The Yorktown campaign the following year will also be shaped by intelligence efforts. Intelligence was woven into Washington's military strategy, and behind these requests for information were the people who risked their lives to gather it, like James Fayette. Born into slavery in Virginia, James learned to read and write in both English and French before working as a spy on behalf of the Patriots during the American Revolution. In this role, he gathered critical information on British forces that helped to pave the way for the American victory at Yorktown.
They were gathering intel that really supported Washington in finally winning in Yorktown. And there are all these great details. Lafayette will write to George Washington and say, this servant I've told you about, he's in Cornwallis's tent, but he can't get near the desk. And we don't know if James could be this servant or if James is the person that is connecting with the servant, because he could have traveled in and out of the British camps pretending to be a forager, selling goods, selling materials, trading. What a great way to overhear what the soldiers are saying, what the movements are. He might have pretended to be a runaway who is seeking freedom with the British, because that was offered to people who ran away from enslavement by patriots. Or he might have truly been this servant in Cornwallis's tent. We don't know, but we do know that he gathered intelligence, and we know that he slipped some disinformation behind enemy lines. We don't know what it was, but something to fool the British about American intentions, what we were planning. We don't know the details of that, but we know it was incredibly dangerous for him to be carrying information on him, because if you're caught by the Patriots, you're going to look like you've stolen secrets from the Americans. If you're caught by the British, what are you doing? Either way, he could have been hung. So somehow he got information into the British hands that was incorrect and helpful to the Patriots.
To hear more about James, listen to Season 2, Episode 4. James's story raises an important question. If espionage was designed to leave as little trace as possible, how do we know what we know? Especially when that spy was an enslaved Black man whose voice was so rarely preserved in the historical record.
It's amazing how much we know about James, while it's still not a lot. But soldiers, enslaved people who fought for the Patriots could be freed after the war because they had been soldiers. But James was a spy, and there was no mechanism to guarantee him being freed because he'd been a spy. He hadn't officially been a soldier. And enslavers were reimbursed for their people who then were freed. So Armistead was supportive of James being free, but he wanted to be paid back. So James had to really officially receive that endorsement, emancipation from Virginia, in order for Armistead to be compensated for the loss of James. And so James petitioned once for freedom, and he described some of his activities, and he was turned down. And then the Marquis de Lafayette wrote him a commendation and talked about James's work for him. That then was attached to James's second petition. And that is one of the ways that we know that he worked with the Marquis and what he did. So with the second petition, James is freed. And then years later, James files for a pension. And then we get fresh information in that document where he's filing for a Revolutionary War pension. So we got a little more information about James and what he did during the war. And that is the one, I believe, where he is saying he sought to support the Marquis. Others in his position would not have done that, but he wanted to assist the patriotic cause. He wanted to work with the Marquis de Lafayette. So we've got these several documents that help us know that this is really true. And then there are a couple of wonderful things. There is a novel called Edge Hill. So it's written by this man and it's published in Richmond. It's a romance of the time period of the Revolutionary War. There is a spy in it, and he's very much more in our James Bond kind of world, because this James, the Sable spy, he is the Sable spy. So this notice, this kind of glamorous way of describing him as Black, and he attempts to assassinate Benedict Arnold in this novel. So how interesting this is. James is this character, this spy character in Edge Hill. Well, the man who wrote it is the man who signed off on James's pension in Richmond. So he knew him. He knew him. He's the guy who, when James goes to get his stipend, this man is signing off. So he knew him. So you're like, oh my goodness, I wonder if James really did attempt to assassinate Benedict Arnold.
Only a fraction of intelligence missions have been traced and corroborated through primary sources. The rest have either endured largely through family or community tradition, passed down across generations, or have been lost to history. For example, after the war, many of the Culper spies continued to live their normal lives, not wanting an onslaught of attention or major recognition for their efforts.
One of my favorite members of the Culper ring, Robert Townsend, went to his grave with no one knowing that he actually was a patriot. It was not discovered until the 1920s. A historian noticed that his writing looked like the writing of this spy, and he outed him. Morton Pennypacker figured out that Robert Townsend was Culper Jr. in the 1920s. That is called deep cover. Deep, deep cover. People really just blended into their lives, moved on. It's like after all the people who worked in code breaking at Bletchley Park in England during World War II, they didn't mention that. No one knew that their mom, their grandma had been a code breaker, had worked at Bletchley Park on this top secret information they weren't supposed to tell. And I think we can't know. I hope we never know what it's like to have a conflict in our country as people from this part of the world, Virginia, Maryland, DC. We had the American Revolution. We had the Civil War in these parts. You probably just want to heal after you've had the kind of conflict where families were ripped apart. I don't know if I want to tell my neighbors. Like, there's a reason Robert Townsend, even though the American side won and he supported it, for some reason, he didn't want anyone to know he'd done that. There's one thing in thinking about spies of the past and spies today that doesn't change. When you're talking about the human beings who spy, there's a fun spying acronym, MICE. And it talks about the four things that get people to spy. And one is money. And one is ideology. Maybe you support a cause so much that you will betray your country, but it's because you actually think in a way it's for the good of your country or the good of the world. The C in MICE is compromise, and that means you're being blackmailed. They have something on you. And then there is the E of ego. And Benedict Arnold is quite a story. He was not getting the love, the praise that he felt he deserved. And so he's going to betray his not even yet a country. And so these are all still really valid today. If you're looking, why do people spy? It's probably going to fall in one of those categories. And I thought that was a fun commonality with the past, and quite clearly seeing our star trader fall into ego.
The motivations that drive people to become spies have not changed much over the centuries, and neither have the basic methods that they use. They've just been adapted with new technology. After the war, one British intelligence officer, Major George Beckwith, reportedly said, "Washington did not really outfight the British. He simply outspied us." Whether or not he ever actually said this is a little beside the point. The phrase endures because the sentiment holds true. Intelligence was one of the Continental Army's greatest advantages. Thank you so much to Amanda Olkey for helping bring the world of Revolutionary War espionage to life. To learn more about the history of intelligence and espionage, visit the International Spy Museum or check them out online at spymuseum.org. Join us next time as we turn to the Southern Campaign and explore the next chapter of the American Revolution.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.